insane on an outfit. Uh-uh, maybe this ain't even out yet. Fashion shows, fancy clothes. That's just the way it goes. Fashion shows, fancy clothes.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
What is the law? 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 What is the law?
Bonjour et bienvenue à Legalese, un podcast de Radlaw McGill qui pousse pour une éducation critique et accessible de droit. I'm Christophe, and I'll be your host this week. Last Monday, January 10th, the Tribunal Administratif du Travail heard for a second day Provost Manfredi and Francis Desjardins, McGill's Director of Labor and Employee Relations. What were they talking about? They're opposing McGill Law Prof's effort to unionize, and therefore constitute McGill's very first union of professors, although about 2,000 workers are already unionized within the university. On November 24th, the interim president of the Association of McGill Professors of Law, Evan Fox Decent, announced that it was organizing to become a certified faculty association. Here is the association's announcement of their campaign to unionize. For the first time in its 200-year history, a group of McGill professors has petitioned the Tribunal Administratif du Travail to be recognized under the Quebec Labor Code as a bargaining unit with authority to pursue a collective agreement. A supermajority of professors from the Faculty of Law has signed membership cards to allow the Association of McGill Professors of Law, AMPL, to act as their members' exclusive bargaining agent. We call on McGill University to stop wasting government funding, student fees, and alumni donations litigating against one of its prized faculties, says Evan Fox Decent, interim president of AMPL. We organize to protect the law faculty's distinctive teaching and research culture, its bilingualism, and to advance our collective desire to ensure equity and diversity for the benefit of our community. We want to give faculty members a voice in shaping decisions that impact not only faculty, but also students, instructors, staff, and alumni. Inspired by independent faculty associations, such as those representing professors of engineering at the University of Sherbrooke and professors of law at Osgoode Hall Law School, AMPL views collective representation at the faculty level as indispensable to preserve its faculty's local self-governance. The purpose of our faculty association is to uphold the mission and collegiality of our law faculty, says Richard Yanda, interim secretary of AMPL. Law is the top-ranked faculty at McGill internationally because it has governed itself as a vibrant intellectual community. Collective representation will mean greater democracy and transparency in the governance of our faculty. Strengthening the rule of law in our workplace will provide greater autonomy for the faculty to pursue academic excellence. AMPL is committed to defending the authority of McGill Law's Faculty Council to govern its members' teaching, research, and service to the broader intellectual community. Faculty self-governance and collective representation is the norm within Quebec and Canadian universities and other post-secondary institutions. The creation of AMPL rests legally on the right of freedom of association. This right has long been recognized by international law and by Canadian courts in decisions addressing Section 2D of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And so we chatted with Evan Fox Decent about the stage of the unionizing effort, the crux of McGill's opposition, and the money that McGill is spending on that, and the changes that a union would bring, both for profs and for students.
Sure. My name's Evan Fox Decent. I'm a full professor, Canada Research Chair in Cosmopolitan Law and Justice at the Faculty of Law here at McGill University.
You were telling me that you've been a faculty member for about 20 years.
Almost 20 years. Well, I came here on a post, I've been at McGill for almost 20 years. I came here on a postdoctoral fellowship in the fall of 2003. So I guess by the this coming fall will make it 19 years. And I was appointed to faculty in 2005. So I guess I've been on faculty now 16 years. 16 going 17 years.
Does that make you one of the veteran of the faculty?
It puts me, well, let's put it this way. I'm much closer to the veteran side of things than I am the rookie side of things. But I think all of us who came in around the time I came in, it's just, you know, the weeks and the months can pass quite slowly, but the years just seem to have melted away. And I certainly don't feel at all much older than I did when I came in, though. In fact, of course, I am.
Okay, that's great. So we're here to talk about the unionization efforts of the profs at McGill. So I guess as a first question, we could talk about what's the current employment situation of profs at McGill, and is it common to all profs within all faculty, or is McGill particular in any way?
Right. So what is common to all professors, tenure track professors at McGill, not charge de cours, course lecturers, they are unionized, is that tenure and tenure track professors at McGill are not unionized. That is, they do not belong to a faculty association that is recognized to have legitimate legal authority to represent them in collective bargaining negotiations with McGill. So in that sense, all of McGill's profs at present have the same status. They are in what in labor law terms is often referred to as a master-servant relationship of employment, which is one that of course is subject to statute and regulations within McGill, but not subject to a collective agreement. And McGill profs are among the very last professors, not simply in Quebec, but across Canada, not to enjoy the protection and the security and the simple sense of knowing where you stand that one has when one works under a collective agreement.
Why is that? Why is McGill so exceptional?
Why is McGill so exceptional? Well, I think part of it has to do with McGill's history. There was a general push to unionize universities in Quebec that was almost universal. There was a Polytechnic Institute that did not become unionized as well as McGill in the 1970s. Now it operates privately. McGill, for whatever reason, did not organize, the professors did not organize at that time. But I should point out that things really have changed quite drastically from the 1970s, even within McGill. It's now the case that the charges de cours, the course lecturers are unionized, clerical workers are unionized, service workers are generally unionized. In fact, virtually all groups of people who are employees of McGill at McGill, other than management and excluded people who are excluded for that reason, are unionized and work under collective agreements. We are, in a sense, the last holdout of what is already an exceptional situation, not simply in Quebec, but across Canada.
Okay. What prompted the unionization effort and how did that happen?
Right. Well, I think there are a number of, you know, longstanding issues at the Faculty of Law that led my colleagues at the faculty to come to the conclusion that seeking out a collective bargaining regime was the best thing that we could do for the faculty at this time. The most significant, I think, of which is that the faculty itself is highly distinctive, has a highly distinctive teaching program, does something, of course, that no other faculty does in McGill, which is accredit students to go out and become qualify students to go out and become accredited across Canada, and in fact, across the world, eventually, should students wish to do so, to work as lawyers. And we do this through the delivery of a very innovative and bilingual program, a program that in any case is far more bilingual than any program that I'm aware of that is otherwise delivered at McGill. So it was with this context in mind that with the return to class, many of us were concerned going into the end of the summer that case numbers of for COVID were rising, and a number of us petitioned our dean to petition the provost to give us a breather, just give us a period of time during which colleagues who are nervous about their own vulnerability, the vulnerabilities of the people they were living with, could teach if they wished remotely, perhaps until the end of September. And so a number of us petitioned our dean to ask the provost. A number of us also signed, over 30 of us, I think some 35 or 37 of us, of law professors, signed a letter asking McGill to impose a proof of vaccination requirement or testing regime so that for people going back into the classroom, we would have as safe an environment as possible. These messages and in-house communications happened toward the end of August. And most regrettably, what this seemed to produce was the memo that came to be circulated widely was directed toward chairs and unit heads from the provost of August 29, threatening unspecified discipline against faculty members should they teach remotely and not in person because they were fearful for the COVID implications for themselves or members of their family living under, even those living under the same roof as them. That caused quite an outcry in the faculty. We passed resolutions within our faculty council on, I believe, September 24th, affirming the jurisdiction of our faculty council under our university statutes to govern our teaching, including mode of delivery, asking our dean within another resolution to strike a committee to develop guidelines, which was eventually done. But it was during that process that we really came to the conclusion that even if we were to succeed to the extent that we could possibly hope to succeed through this committee and through faculty council to bring these guidelines into effect, what was really at the heart of the issue was simply a lack of equality between us and the university when it came to talk about and negotiate our fundamental terms of employment, including health and safety terms. And I think it was that sentiment, really more than anything else, that was, you know, let's call it the bale of hay that broke the camel's back, that inspired many of my colleagues to come to me and others and ask if this was a possibility. And it was sort of one of those things that initially was, you know, somewhat abstract, but that became concrete much more quickly than we imagined. And, you know, before we knew it, we had a majority and then a very substantial majority of our colleagues having signed union cards to join our faculty association to seek certification so that we can, in fact, negotiate a collective agreement between professors of our faculty and the university, which would be the first time that this would happen, of course, in 200 years. It's never happened before at McGill.
Amazing. And could you quantify the supermajority? How many profs?
I'm a little reluctant to do that, but let's just say we have enough faculty members who've signed up, the percentage of which would usually be enough to change a constitution in most countries. And I'll say that as part of the process, we went out of our way to speak to virtually every faculty member before filing for certification. And in fact, a general meeting was called by a colleague, where all colleagues had the opportunity to participate, let their voices be heard on the matter. And the colleague who called the meeting, well, I'm not going to say anything more than simply that there was a full opportunity for people to air their views. We filed for certification 3 days after that. Between the meeting and the time we filed for certification, three additional colleagues had signed union cards.
Okay, great. And also, so I'm hearing that like COVID-19 sort of like prompted this unionization drive, and well, very recently, the School of Social Work decided to teach remotely until March. So against, I guess, the like university guidelines, and then the university administration sort of, I don't know exactly how it happened, but like, I guess, not threatened them, but like made them go back on that.
It certainly seems that there was a decision made in social work to teach remotely until after the break. And then there was pressure from central administration for them not to do that, even though, once again, Senate gives very clear authority to the faculties to govern their mode of teaching. And so long as the decision was made consistent with Senate regulations and university statutes, it's unclear, quite frankly, what authority central administration had to intervene in this manner at all. Now, I will say this: although COVID did to some extent provide the impetus for our faculty to seek unionization, it would be, I think, a mischaracterization to say that that is the fundamental justification for why we're doing it. I mean, the real reason for why we're doing it, and a lot of my colleagues, quite frankly, regret that it's happening at a time of COVID and would have preferred for this to happen in more normal times when we could have had more extensive discussions, perhaps, about the prospect and fact of doing it. But what really lies at the bottom of it, more than anything, much more than COVID, is simply the sense of being unequal in an employment relationship when one side really cannot bargain on anything resembling terms of equality with the other, which is standard in employer-employee relations, of course, and is the very reason that people collectivize and seek to bargain collectively. Because then they do have an opportunity. We will have an opportunity to engage with McGill on more equal terms and participate constructively and fruitfully with McGill on more equal terms in terms of with respect to developing policies that are of benefit to all.
Yeah. So what would be like the material impacts of unionization on your working conditions as profs?
Well, in terms of our working conditions, we've made it very clear from the beginning that for us, this is not really something that we're doing with an eye on compensation per se, or to try to get some advantage with respect to that. Really, what this is about for faculty at the Faculty of Law is about strengthening our faculty's autonomy, the autonomy that historically it has had and exercised over years to, for example, develop the world's first trans-systemic legal education project, teaching the civil law and the common law together. In more recent years, responding to call to action number 28 of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission by doing, among other things, making the teaching of Indigenous legal traditions a mandatory part of our first year curriculum. Again, completely unique unique in the world, unique in Canada to be doing this, and to be doing it, of course, from our faculty. So what we really are trying to do is just provide a framework to continue to innovate in these kinds of ways with greater security than we have had now. And frankly, with the security that one gets by working within a collective collectively bargained regime, which means that unfortunately, when there is foul weather, as inevitably there is between employees and employers at times, we do, should it be necessary, have the opportunity to seek an independent grievance and arbitration mechanism, or take advantage of that, which at present, of course, we do not. Mm-hmm. We do not have access to.
Qui, bon, là, je vais switcher au français, mais dans le fond,
non, c'est bon,
ce que j'allais mentionner là, quand je parlais de l'école de travail social, c'est que, bon, tu sais, cette inégalité dans les rapports employés-employeurs-là, puis les effets de la pandémie, tu sais, sont vécus across the board, I assume, by like all profs of all faculties. Fait que, est-ce que il y a d'autres facultés dont les professeurs essaient de se syndiquer en ce moment?
In McGill or outside?
In McGill. In McGill? Yeah.
Honestly, I don't know. It is up to the faculty members of other faculties to decide if they want to follow this path or if they want to continue as they have been. We are at present we are nose down. We're in the middle of a hearing, of contested hearings, where McGill is basically pulling out all stops and throwing the proverbial kitchen sink at us to try to defeat our attempt to be certified. So we aren't so much as besieged at the present time as in open, hostile, battlefield conflict litigation with McGill before the Tribunal Administratif du Travail. We've had 2 days of hearings already. Some of those, at moments, the hearings and the discussions in the hearings have been quite heated, but they've also been greatly beneficial in terms of the light they have shone on the nature of our employment relationship with McGill to this point, and ways we can try to improve it into the future.
Okay, so again, that transitions well into our next question, which is the stage you're in now, if you want to like expand on that. So you've mentioned that you are seeking certification at the Tribunal Administratif du Travail. And I guess we're just going to specify at that point that McGill administration did not have to contest that, could have just let that go.
Once we filed for certification, all employers have the option of recognizing the bargaining unit. That's what we would be called under the labor code at our faculty, a bargaining unit if we're successful, or they can challenge it and propose another bargaining unit. So McGill has said that no, they don't think the professors in the Faculty of Law should be recognized as a bargaining unit, that the appropriate bargaining unit is all the professors of McGill. So there are about 1,750 tenured track professors at McGill, and McGill's position is that they believe that that is the appropriate bargaining unit, not the professors from the Faculty of Law. So we are in hearings right now. We've had 2 days of hearings. We had McGill has the burden of proof to show that the bargaining unit we're proposing is not viable, by which I mean they have to show that for some reason we are incapable of, as members of a faculty, bargaining a collective agreement with the university. We think we stand on very solid legal ground in that now freedom of association is clearly, in the wake of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms and the Quebec Charter, clearly recognized to include freedom of association. Freedom of association, is clearly recognized to include the right to associate collectively and bargain collectively. We also believe that we're in a very good position in that we are clearly our own distinctive community of interest, which is the fundamental criterion for determining whether or not a bargaining unit really is an appropriate or viable bargaining unit. Is it a distinctive community of interest? We think at the Faculty of Law that we are, that we that our fundamental workplace is the Faculty of Law. We spend very little time outside of it at the university, not no time, but little time. And of course, our boss is the dean. That's who we interact with on a regular basis with respect to our teaching loads, with respect to negotiating our salary. He determines our merit pay. All of the things that typically go into, you know, what's at the heart of an employment relationship are determined between us and our dean, with very little, with us having very little to say to the university at large. And of course, the dean has to operate within envelopes that the university provides him, but it is the dean who makes the discretionary decisions that that fundamentally shape our workplace. So that is the question. That's the issue that's being discussed and being litigated now at the labor board, or the Tribunal Administratif du Travail. And we've had 2 days so far. It seems, so far as we can tell, that that things have gone well for us, and we're hopeful that on our third day, which will be February 14th. That we'll be able to continue to make our case to the judge at the labor board.
And what are McGill's administration arguments based on that this is not the good bargaining unit?
Well, it seems their initial argument on the first day seemed to be that there are all kinds of regulations, like regulations on getting tenure, regulations on taking leave, regulations on a variety of matters that govern us across the university that are common across faculties. And so it seems that they wish to say that the commonality of those means that one particular faculty cannot exist by itself in a collective agreement kind of situation. In fact, we already have something like that in McGill in two senses. So course lecturers, chargés de cours, have a union, but then we have running, you know, parallel to them, faculty lecturers who are not unionized, and adjunct professors who are not unionized, who occupy similar roles. We also have service personnel in McGill who, although they're recognized by one union, and often do the same work and could work in different parts of McGill, have different bargaining units. So it's very common that in a large organization, in fact, it's almost the rule in a large organization, that you will have more than one bargaining unit if you have a significant number of employees, especially if they do different work. So, you know, what is really key about our situation is that at a university, generally speaking, or at least at the Faculty of Law, we're not interchangeable. You can't go to the engineering faculty and bring an engineer in to teach administrative law, which is what I teach. And nor could I go, you know, to the engineering faculty and teach them anything about mining or civil engineering. The things that we do are highly specialized, highly particular, and our individual faculties, as is borne out by McGill's own documents, reflect pay scales that have an eye to the outside market, which is different for different faculties. So we think we're distinctive in all manner of ways. And I don't want to speak too much about the hearing and the procedure that's still ongoing, but we're very optimistic at this stage, at least at the very least, cautiously optimistic that things at the hearing are going well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And so what is, in your opinion, at the bottom of like McGill's administration position? Like, why are they
fighting the union? So
why? Much? Yeah, exactly. And like, let's specify here that like for Rome and Freddy spent two, like almost full days contesting it at the hearing at the Tribunal Administratif du Travail. So why are they obsessive over that?
You know, that is a great question, but I would beg you to ask them that question, because we would love to know the answer too. I mean, we have no intention on, you know, doing anything but proceeding in the most collegial manner possible. One of the beautiful things about Quebec's labor regime is that once a bargaining unit certifies, it's guaranteed to get a collective agreement. So we're not going to certify and then not come to a collective agreement, and then we're going to be striking and it's going to be pickets and, you know, war in the street. Nothing like that at all. The way it works in Quebec is if we get certified, we go into collective bargaining with McGill. We're very lucky to have received the support of the Canadian Association of University Teachers, of Quebec's version of that, the FQPPU. They have experts with lots of experience at collective bargaining that they've already advised us will be willing to help us when we get to that stage. They're already helping us to pay for our legal expenses at the tribunal right now. So we hope that collegially we'll be able to reach a productive collective agreement with McGill. But should we have difficulty doing so, there's a procedure in place. And the procedure is a conciliator is appointed. If conciliation fails, then it goes to arbitration. And an arbitrator sets the terms of the first collective agreement. So what we essentially have then is an independent, impartial third party decides what are the best, fairest, most appropriate terms for us to work under, as opposed to the situation we have now, which is that in truth, there is no organization at McGill legally authorized to represent us in bargaining with McGill. We do have a University Teachers Association, the McGill Association of University Teachers. But management, are members of that association. So Provost Manfredi is a member of MAUT. Our Dean Leckie is a member of MAUT. It works through a system of what is described as collegial governance, where there are a number of committees that meet regularly, that have representatives from MAUT that come from the ranks of the professoriate, and often, typically, our interests are aligned and things work out well, but then sometimes they are not. So MAUT took a strong position with respect to COVID and the idea of proof of vaccination in August and September, wrote a strong letter asking for the administration to bring in a proof of vaccination requirement. And they were, you know, quite frankly, ignored. And they received exactly the same treatment that the majority of law profs who signed on to a similar letter that was sent to central administration received exactly the same sort of response. Just, mm-hmm. We're not going to do this. Thank you for your concern. And that's it. And that is sort of if you aren't organized, that's the end of it. You ask for a little more, and you're told you can have a little more or you cannot have a little more. You can participate a little more or not participate a little more. And there's really no recourse past that in terms of policy setting. Once you have a collective bargaining framework in place, however, then you actually have something you can sit down and talk about and revisit and use as a living document, a living constitution of the workplace conditions you work under, typically on a three-year basis.
I'm curious, who is the administration responsive to then? If like, yeah, you've just talked about like the MAUT not being able to influence its policies, to like prof sort of organizing.
And... There was a lot of speculation as to who the administration, there has been a lot of speculation about who the administration has been responding to resist as strenuously as they did a vaccine mandate, for example. And some have speculated that it was the administration adopting a close, possibly too close relationship to Quebec City that did not want, apparently, universities to adopt a vaccine mandate and denominated universities as essential services akin to, for example, grocery stores where you would not have to show, you know, the kind of vaccine code that you have to show to go into a restaurant. To be honest, I don't want to speculate on what our university administrators motives are. I think these are people who have, especially now, extremely difficult jobs made so much more difficult by COVID. So I do have great sympathy for them. At the same time, I hope they can show a like sympathy and recognize that we aren't looking for anything more than an ability to communicate and work with them on a slightly more equal footing.
Mm-hmm. And just before we move out of the earring subject, sure. Is there things you'd like to share about, like, what you've discovered at the hearings? Or I know you've mentioned that you don't want to expand on that too much, so we can also move on.
There have been some documents that have surfaced at the hearing that show a governance structure that many of us who've been there have been surprised to discover, because we didn't know it existed before. And that governance structure is essentially a regularized set of meetings between the dean of our faculty, and we've subsequently learned the deans of all faculties, and the provost, that lead to yearly faculty agreements. These have not been made public to McGill professors, law professors, or other professors. We were able to overcome strenuous objections from McGill to get faculty agreements. These faculty agreements that are literally signed by the dean and by the provost on a yearly basis from McGill through the hearing at our last session on Monday. And on Monday, we were again able to secure an undertaking from McGill over McGill's objections, but the judge overruled, to get the last year's faculty agreements from every faculty at McGill. So this will be those will be forthcoming prior to February 14th, and once they're entered into evidence, we will move to make those available. This will be the first. These faculty agreements have overviews of faculty priorities, budget lines, hiring lines, the anticipated size that faculties are moving toward, enrollments, goals, all of the sort of nitty gritty granular stuff that you would hope would be the meat and potatoes of discussions at faculty councils and within faculties more generally, and that we hope to make the meat and potatoes of our discussion with the administration once we're certified and we have a collective bargaining regime in place.
Mm-hmm. It's really
and
nice
within enough. And within our ordinary, of course, structures, primarily faculty council.
Yeah, not totally. Yeah, I'm happy to hear that we're all gonna benefit from their transparency regarding the governance that you're able to sort of extract from the hearing. So looking forward to see those documents for sure.
And now we're up for a break with Dolly Parton, but don't go anywhere, because when we're back, the conversation with Evan Fox Decent continues, digging into what the university community stands to gain by the prof's unionization.
This is Nancy from Not You, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, Quebec.
And I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping, with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind. Watch him shatter. You're just a step on the boss man's ladder, but you got dreams he'll never take away.
the same boat with a lot of your friends, waiting for the day your ship will come in and the tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and you never get the credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. 9 to 5, yeah, they got you where they want you. There's a better life and you think about it, don't you? It's a rich man's game, no matter what they call.
Okay, and also before I was thinking, I was under like an impression that tenured prof were kind of on the top of the university's power pyramid, and which obviously has been deconstructed when I became closer with some academics and some tenured prof that said to have experienced total exclusion from administrative decision-making processes, as you were mentioning, or like a perpetual pressure to publish. And yeah, basically a lot of like very draining requirements that flow from democratization of higher education institutions, among others. So I just, yeah, I would like to hear you on that, as I think this is to me like a very fertile ground for solidarity between students and professors. Thank
you. Well, so, you know, we have at the faculty felt creeping managerialism, creeping corporatization of processes that historically were dealt with on an entirely local basis at the faculty. So it's, I mean, so to be sure, part of the motivation of us organizing now is to strengthen our local autonomy, our local self-government, so that we can control, you know, the times at which, for example, our colleagues teach, where we teach, where we can buy computers, you know, when we need to buy computers or electronic or teaching equipment or media equipment, how we seek reimbursement for expenses, or even put together course packs. All of these things, not too long ago, were dealt with at a very, you know, at a very local level, at our faculty level, and we've been really over the last 10 years in a constant struggle to keep things at our faculty level, where it seems that there's been an ongoing push to centralize everything. And so, of course, that's something that, you know, we think for reasons of subsidiarity, we think we are closest, you know, to our students and our community, and as our community is closest to us, and so that together we have a best sense of how to deal with the issues that most affect our community, whether it's issues of equity, inclusion, diversity, teaching load for profs, teaching load distributed between undergraduate teaching and graduate supervision, all number of issues. We want to ensure they either remain at a local, at our faculty level, or those that are tending to move to a centralized level, to try to put a brake on that, and even reverse it if possible through collective bargaining. So we hear that. We certainly hear what you're saying. And let me just say that we have been tremendously enthused and buoyed by the solidarity that we have received from students. We've received financial and moral solidarity from CAUT, from the course lecturers union, from the graduate students from union, from our clerical staffs union. So the unions across McGill have been nothing but generous and forthcoming and supportive of us, as have our students. And frankly, this is we're at the most fragile and precarious time of our existence, and so it's greatly appreciated.
I'm glad to hear that. And I've heard a rumor that, like, maybe not a rumor, but that, like, the law faculty and the music faculty were the most decentralized one, so had the most sort of power within the university. Is that true? Because I've also...
I don't know. So honest to goodness, I've gone to a couple of productions put on by members of our music faculty, but I wouldn't even pretend to begin to suggest what sort of influence or power or autonomy the faculty of music has. And as for the faculty of law, well, the proof will be in the pudding within probably 4 or 5 weeks. We'll know if we're able to secure a certification. That will certainly be that will certainly put us in a much better position than we are now to participate constructively in the delivery of the teaching and research and service missions that we're all committed to.
Okay, that's great. So I was going to ask you what you were expecting to flow from the unionization effort moving forward, but you already said you were feeling confident. And preparing for the conversation, I read an article by Diane Reddy, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that well.
That sounds right.
Which was titled, like, Labor Bargaining and the Common Good. And it was mentioning how in the US, like the teachers' labor unions were instrumental to closing schools when then President Trump wouldn't do so, or state governors. I don't know exactly what's the separation of power there, which I think all children, families, and communities benefited from. So if certification was granted, so what do you think that all faculty members, that is, like, us too as students, who are going to feel its positive impacts?
I think so. And I can tell you why. Because right now, without certification, people out there, including in the Faculty of Law, tenured professors who I know as a student you must look to and think are sort of on an occupy a kind of exalted status, tenured colleagues of mine, some of them with chairs, are terrified to speak out against university authorities. Terrified. Not that they necessarily believe that they will be punished directly, like they will be, you know, given less pay or given more work, but because our cachet comes from the bestowal of benefits on us. So in my case, for example, I'm very fortunate to have a chair. In the case of other colleagues, they will be nominated for awards, such as the Principal's Award for Teaching and all sorts of awards that are granted by bodies external to McGill. To get one of those awards, you need the support of your faculty. And to do well in promotion when you're going up for tenure, going up for associate professor, going up for full professor, at all these stages along the way, you need faculty support. And I can tell you that we have colleagues in the Faculty of Law now with tenure who are supportive of what we're doing and who would not sign confidential union cards simply because they're afraid of that confidence not holding up, it's somehow getting out, and there being repercussions on them. Possibly just a withdrawal of benefits or a resistance to provide benefits. Now, you might say, oh, they're, you know, that's overblown, or they don't need to have these fears, but those fears are real. Whether people have to have those fears or not, or they're rational, they're real. They do have them. I can promise you have them. They have them because I've spoken to virtually every member of our faculty, and I know they're real. And to me, one of the great things that we're going to get through certification is the sense, is the confidence, hopefully, on the part of those people that they don't have to have an attitude, quite frankly, of a certain amount of bowing and scraping, right? And deference to authority. We are, a number of us are, you know, just by nature, outspoken, and you know, sort of treat authority on the virtue of the merits that authority espouses rather than the position that it occupies. But we are in a hierarchy, and I think that when we have the benefit of grievance procedures from which one can be dismissed and indeed disciplined only for cause, and the people ultimately deciding those questions will be independent arbitrators who are independent from McGill, I think we'll be in a much better place as a community, and in a much better place to support our students and to support the wider community that we serve.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's definitely what I'm getting from our conversation, that like it's going to facilitate our organizing if you get your certification, because McGill is just this, like, a masterpiece, and it's so hard to like channel grievances, student grievances, yeah, sometimes, because it's always I don't know, like I've been to a couple of committee meetings, various committees meetings last year, and no committee was like able to take any resolution or action. It was always like, oh, we're gonna write a recommendation and it's gonna go up and go up. So that's great. And finally, so how can students best support you?
Oh, well, thank you very much. Very, very simply, three concrete things. The first is to write individual letters to Dean Leckie and to Provost Manfredi, asking them to stop spending student fees fighting our attempt at certification, to redirect those fees to virtually anything else which would be more productive than where they're diverting them now. So that would be, those are two things. That would be one thing, individual letters to Dean Leckie and Provost Manfredi. I would also encourage, if students were of a mind, to do a petition with the same request to please stop spending our precious fees and public resources on this kind of union busting litigation. That we can all do better if we work collectively, listen to the supermajority of the faculty that is much prized at McGill for good reason. And on the other side of it, we promise and we commit to negotiate collectively in good faith from start to finish. And finally, the absolute last thing that students can do that I think is perhaps of most importance is come to the hearing on February 14th. It is almost certain to be virtual. There's and held via Zoom. We were delighted to see scores of students and colleagues in attendance last time. The university does not particularly wish for this to be a publicly attended event, but I think it's enormously helpful for students, and in particular law students, to see just where the rubber hits the road in labor law. And this is it. This is like the most important moment of a labor movement's history, whether it can have a history, or it's the question of whether it can have an existence or not. We want to have an existence so that we can work better for all people associated with the Faculty of Law and beyond at McGill. And we're very hopeful that in the next few weeks, the Labor Board will certify us and we'll be able to move forward in that direction.
That covers everything. Is there something you'd like to add?
Audrey, that was amazing. Thank you very much to you and Legalese for doing this. I think it's just wonderful. This is a great way for us, you know, to get the word out about what we're doing. We are going to, you know, try to keep students and others updated. We're limited in what we can say as we are in the midst of a legal process, an ongoing legal process. But you can, of course, inform yourselves directly by simply attending that process. And I can promise you that in the not too distant future, we will be making available the publicly available documents that are publicly available now for the first time that have to do with just how our university is actually governed at the granular level.
That was Legalese's Audrey speaking with McGill Law Prof Evan Fox-Decent. Vous écoutez une émission de Legalese sur CKUT 90.3 FM. That's all from us today. Thank you for listening, and thanks to everyone who contributed to the show. You can listen to Legalese every second Friday of the month from 11 a.m. till 12 noon on CKUT 90.3 FM. If you have ideas of topics you'd like us to cover, legal or not, you can write to us at legalese@ckut.ca. Find us on SoundCloud at CKUT Legalese. Extended versions of the interviews you hear on some of our shows are available there. And don't forget to tune in to the Profs Union hearing on the 14th of February.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a walk in that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert. All around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. Voice was chanting as the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
As I went walking, I saw a sign there, and on the sign it said no trespassing, but on the other side it didn't say nothing, and that sign was made for you and me.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
In the shadows of the steeple, I saw my people. In the relief office, I saw my people. As they stood hungry, I stood there asking, is this land really made for you and me? Stop me as I go walking my freedom highway. Nobody living can make me turn back.
This land was made for you and me.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters.
CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. No boundaries. Feel alive.
Afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing you a wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked at the CKT 90.3 FM.